Welcome to episode number 207 of the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, John Zombro, physical therapist and peak performance coach, and today I have a very special show for you guys because with me is Ryan Jordan. Ryan is an engineer and a data scientist, and he's the founder of BackpackingLight.com. In our discussion, Ryan describes how he has taken backpacking to the ultimate athletic level in terms of preparation, training, and applications. I think you're going to love this show as much as I enjoyed speaking with Ryan about his perspectives as a lifetime athlete. Hey folks, welcome to the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, John Zombro, and here today, it's my great honor, it's my great privilege to be talking to lifetime athlete, founder of BackpackingLight.com, and all-around great guy, Ryan Jordan. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's great to touch base with you again.
Absolutely, my pleasure. And the history that we have goes back a bit as it relates to the genesis of this episode. And so I would say, I was talking to you last week, actually, on your podcast, and I think we're now at 15 years, roughly, where you know, we've been acquaintances.
I would say closer to 17. Yeah.
Okay.
I started training with you before my trip to the Arctic in 2006. In 2005, I broke my back, and that's when I actually started rehabbing and getting ready for the Arctic trip, and that's when I first came to you.
It's an amazing journey that we're all on. And I think that really feeds into what we're going to be talking about today. And so if I frame up the show for our listeners, one of the things that I really enjoy doing is visiting with so many wonderful people, all walks of life and all walks of sports and activities. And Ryan is someone who has taken backpacking essentially to the highest levels of athleticism. And I think that makes it very cogent for our conversation today. So maybe if I turn it over to you, Ryan, maybe just start off talking any way that you would like about your personal history with backpacking.
You bet. I've been backpacking since I was a kid and really fell in love with it through scouting as a 10 and 11 year old. And then from there, it blossomed into an alpine climbing activity in my late teens. I became a high adventure hike leader for the Chief Seattle Council of the Boy Scouts in the Seattle area on the Olympic Peninsula, and led teenagers on hikes and climbs around the Olympics. And so this was the genesis of Backpacking Light. So this was, you know, late 1980s. And so we realized that the gear list that the council gave to us, which was long and heavy, caused the scouts a lot of suffering, and they did not appreciate it. And we were unable to do some of the things we wanted to do. So at one point we brought them all into the parade field in preparation for a trip. We put a giant, big garbage can and in the middle of the circle of the scouts, and we made them unpack their packs, and then us as hike leaders would walk around the circle. We would grab whatever gear they brought that we did not think they needed, and we put it in the garbage can, and then we put the lid on the garbage can and said, "You get this all back at the end of the trip." And that trip was pivotal because it allowed us to leave our base camp with pack weights of 20, 22, 23 pounds for a 5-day trip. And our opportunities absolutely exploded open. And so we were able to do 50 miles with young boys on a regular basis in 5 days. On one trip, we were able to do 100 miles. And this allowed us to just kind of open the doors of possibility and say, okay, what do we really need out here that can facilitate what we want to do athletically, physically, as well as what don't we need so that it's not going to lead us to injury and risk and things like that. So that was my pivotal point into the world of lightweight backpacking. But I definitely come from a mountaineering perspective. So growing up in the Pacific Northwest, climbing in the Cascades and the Olympics, in order to bushwhack through the voluminous understory of those mountain ranges, I just did not want to carry a heavy pack. And so it became a practical necessity.
I do recall growing up, I was born in the 60s, grew up in the 70s. We could even say I came of age in the 80s, but in the 70s, my dad and I would take trips together, and I'm going to exaggerate this just for effect, but you know, we did use those very low level aluminum frame packs, and they were exceedingly uncomfortable to wear. And when we first got started, some of the gear that we would use, it wouldn't be far from what I'm going to say was a cast iron skillet and a six pack of soda and several pounds of hamburger and a canvas pup tent with cotton sleeping bags. and we had, and I was a Boy Scout as well. So we had the Boy Scout canteen, that oblong shaped thing, which was popular at the time, as well as of course the mess kit and some other things. But I just remember trudging along and, for lack of a better term, feeling like my soul was being crushed into hell from the weight and just the poor fit and the discomfort. And so I really, you know, I salute you as a pioneer in getting things to where we are today, where it's so pleasant and comfortable to be able to explore the backcountry. And, you know, and I want to make sure that you get credit for a lot of what you've contributed. So kind of moving along, I know there was a lot between where you left off in your journey and where you are now, but if you could fast forward a bit and say, well, what was the beginnings of your company and also some of the great personal inspirations or journeys maybe that that you started to look at?
The modern day lightweight backpacking movement was, the genesis was in the 1990s, mid to late 1990s. And this came about as a result of, lo and behold, the popularity of the internet and the internet starting to make its way into people's homes. And then people wanting to connect with other people around their passions, interests, hobbies, what have you. Lightweight backpacking was one of those. So the internet did not facilitate the development of lightweight backpacking. It merely allowed people who are already doing it to connect to each other, and that definitely spurred the growth of this, what we call industry today. Now, backpacking light, the genesis of it came about when a lot of gear manufacturers were, the outdoor industry was exploding in the 1990s. So people are sort of having a resurgence in backpacking and outdoor activity in general. And there was an explosion of gear onto the market. And so a lot of this gear came about in modern day marketing practices, which were at the trends back then, were they were a little bit manipulative. So we had come out of the recession of the 1970s, we had the dot-com boom of the 1980s, and we have the middle class starting to generate substantial amounts of wealth by the 1990s. And this fueled the outdoor gear industry. And so you've got all this gear on the market, and you've got all this very savvy, sophisticated, persuasive marketing to sell it. And we started to see trends where manufacturers were making claims about gear that just weren't true. And so being an engineer by training and someone who, you know, I'm a kind of a champion for telling honest claims about your gear, this kind of made me mad. And so the motivation was really a little bit of frustration to say, I'm going to write gear reviews that are truthful, honest, and put things in perspective so people don't go out and waste so much money on gear they don't need or won't work for them. So that's really how it started. Now we've come a long way since then and diversified our interests and audience substantially. But this is definitely the catalyst. That gear DNA, that engineering DNA, reliance on data and science still is core to what we believe and how we operate as a company.
Yes, I remember some of that change over the advent of when things were starting to move away from the print catalogs that you would get from Camp Moore or Sierra Trading Post or some of these things, other vendors. And then all of a sudden, oh, you know, now we have, and I won't name the list, but, you know, REI and others. And that was great as a consumer, because it was, oh man, you know, you could look at these things. And as the quality of the websites got better, you know, both in terms of, you know, what you could see and also how you could navigate and shop them. But I was a naive consumer, because I didn't know any better. I didn't know that perhaps I was being misled slightly. And so I appreciate your crusade. Diving in a bit more deeply to the concept of ultralight backpacking, how has that technology evolved?
We have seen so many advances in in material development and product design, with an eye not only on saving weight. I mean, their gear has not gotten that much lighter through the years, I have to be honest with you. And what we've really seen is that the performance of that gear for the weight has gone up dramatically. So we've seen things like silicone coated nylons and polyesters replacing polyurethane coated nylons and polyesters. So the result of that is you've got a much lighter fabric that at a much stronger tear strength. And so we can make some really light tents and tarps out of it. We've seen more abrasion resistant backpacks. Now that the gold standard for backpack fabric is, you know, Cordura, and it still is a fantastic durable backpack fabric, but it's heavy. So now we have some pack fabrics that aren't, you know, they're not quite as abrasion resistant as Cordura, but they're abrasion resistant enough for most people at a much lighter weight. And so that you incorporate something like that into a design, and now you have backpacks that weigh 2, 3, 4 pounds instead of 6, 7, or 8 pounds. So that's the kind of evolution we've seen as an industry. It's always in materials and design, the advent of titanium and carbon fiber and putting those components into hard goods. And then we've seen this shift in mindset. What do people want to do in the backcountry? And someone might be a photographer, someone might be a fisherman, someone might be a climber, and all that stuff can be heavy if you pursue those additional activities in the backcountry. If you're a hunter, you're carrying a gun and ammunition and equipment to dress your game and things like that, and that all adds up. So the trend we've seen is people will lighten their personal and camping equipment so that they can take some of this heavier stuff. So their net pack weight may not have dropped. They may still be carrying 40 or 50 pounds out there, but their capabilities have improved dramatically. So we see that shift. And then the third shift I see is in skills. So we see more and more people spending more and more time on really mastering the art of living comfortably and safely in the backcountry with less gear. And that requires a skills-centric mindset and the ability to practice and hone and refine what you're doing and testing it in inclement conditions and whatnot. And so those are the three trends we see.
Would you say that that's really what your entire mission with backpackinglight.com is? Because I, you know, I've certainly been aware of you for a very long time as we started out the show, and you've got a great rich resource of articles and videos and a podcast, as well as courses that you're doing that really, you know, seems to revolve around empowering people to be well-equipped in terms of their goods, but also their skill set. And so I'm just sort of asking, is that the overriding theme of what you're doing?
Our mission embodies four charges. The first one is we want to be consumer advocates, and we want to teach consumers to be disciplined, intentional consumers. Be careful where you spend your money. You don't need as much as you think. And be careful with marketing messaging. The second charge is that we want you to become a skills expert. We don't want to be the people that tell you what to do and how to do it, but we want to present you with as many options as possible to do your thing in the backcountry. And then you can adopt that and own that skill and adapt it to the style that you want to execute out there. The third thing is, and this has evolved in recent years, is we see a strong need for people to be stewards of our land resources. And this has come about really acutely during the pandemic, because so many new people have been introduced to the sport of hiking and backpacking. And now we see like national parks, the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service kind of scratching their heads and wondering why there's so much trash and violations of LNT guidelines and things like this. And it's simply because of a lack of education. People are new to this activity. Now, there's some that are just insensitive to resource stewardship, and there's not much you can do about that small fraction of people. But the other side can be addressed via education. So that's a huge part of us. The other thing we see that's really important to our mission is we want to encourage backcountry users to be generous community members. We are a community-based organization. We thrive on learning from each other, sharing stories from each other, being inspired from each other. And so encouraging that community is critical to personal growth and development as a backcountry user and resource steward. So those are the four tenets of kind of what we're all about as a company.
And that's an extremely academic and intelligent approach to your passion. Let's get right into that. You talked about stories, so let's make it story time. And I want to keep it open-ended for you, Ryan. So from an athletic perspective, a challenge perspective, perhaps, what is one of your most memorable trips?
Well, to provide some context, my favorite type of trip is a long, drawn-out athletic challenge. And my area of expertise and passion is in doing long distance trips without resupply. So this is in stark contrast to a through hike, where you hike a long trail for 4 or 5 days, stop into town, get your resupply box from the post office or resupply at a grocery store, and then get back on the trail and repeat that process over and over until you banged out a 2,000 or 3,000 mile trail or shorter. And my passion is in doing trips without resupply. So how long can I go without leaving the wilderness, without going into town or a post office? And generally these trips I do are on the order of 200 to 500 plus miles. And so that is my one area of passion. My second area of passion is that I like to be off trail. So I like to go through mountains or deserts and craft routes that are respectful of the geography and topography of the land and kind of go with the flow and really be one with the land. So with that context, probably one of my hallmark, I don't want to say achievements, but most satisfying trips was from Livingston, Montana to Du Bois, Wyoming, along the hydrologic divide of the Absaroka mountain range. And so this is about, you know, it's a snaky divide. It's not a straight line. So you're looking at about 300-ish miles for a route from Livingston Peak, which is the northern terminus, to County Peak, which is the southern terminus. It goes through grizzly bear country. The terrain along the hydrologic divide, there's very, very few trails. And you end up scrambling, and in some cases there's a few technical sections, and you know, just trying to find those nice riding alpine benches at 9,000 feet to get you through the patches of talus and scree that are miserable, you know. So it's a really satisfying type of trip for me, and probably one of the most challenging athletic endeavors I've ever done.
You're a problem solver.
Yeah, interestingly, it took me several years to work this out. Section hiked many, many sections of it before I was able to kind of crack the nut to do it without resupply. And yeah, it is a problem solving exercise for sure.
So I assume at that elevation, this was in the summer, or, you know, late summer, early fall when you were making that trip?
Summer to fall. I've done many sections of it in June and July, which I actually prefer. Taking crampons and an ice axe sped up some of those sections dramatically compared to when they were snow free. When there was no snow on the ground, you have to deal with some pretty intense bushwhacking in sections and some really steep, rotten, loose snow gullies. And so if you have some climbing confidence, alpine climbing confidence, which I do, an ice axe and crampon can, or a set of crampons can really change the route for you and make it quite a bit more efficient.
So 300 plus miles, predominantly alpine terrain. How many days did that take you to do that traverse?
That's a 16 to 18 day traverse generally, if you're going at full bore. This is a full on athletic event. Now, if you were to slow it down a bit, you know, I think this is a reasonable trip for the hiker of good fitness to do in 30 to 35 days. That would slow you down to 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 miles a day, which is it's a healthy pace for sure. But it's one that allows you to slow down and not bang yourself up too bad. At 16 to 18 days, you know, you're looking at 15 plus mile days over incredibly difficult terrain, and that your body is a ticking time bomb in that case. And you are racing to the finish before your body gives out.
I was doing the math on that as we were talking, and I think that's incredibly impressive, not only just to do one day like that, but to string them together back to back. Were you having a lot of encounters with sheep and goats up there?
There are a ton of mountain goats, especially as you get down into the cutoff mountain area just north of Yellowstone Mountain, Yellowstone National Park, and the Slough Creek drainage. That was probably the highest density of goats I saw from there all the way to a little bit south of Cook City. Sheep, I didn't see too many mountain sheep. I did see a couple down in the southern part of the range. And it's infested with bears along the entire length.
Did you have any encounters or issues that are worth mentioning?
No bear encounters on that trip. One of the section hikes I did have a bear encounter in the Slough Creek drainage. I was cooking breakfast on the banks of Slough Creek. This is upper Slough Creek, well outside of the park. And I was watching a grizzly root around in the kind of picking up logs and eating grubs and whatnot, probably some anthills. I saw him about a half mile away, but then he made his way down towards the creek. So I packed up and slowly backed up. I pulled out my bear spray. By now he was probably 70 yards away. And as I was backing up across the creek, trying to keep my eye on him, I tripped and fell in the creek and made a big commotion, and he put his head up and charged. And so I ended up having to spray him, and I just gave him a quick burst, and he didn't like it and ran a mile away and pawed at his face, and it was uneventful from there.
You say that so nonchalantly. That's good.
Oh, it's still makes my heart race to think about it.
But there wasn't any loss of bowel or bladder function.
No, nothing.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, I think I want to circle back to talking about how you put those days together when you're out there, and when you're deciding to stop and select a campsite and sleeping and, you know, food preparation and all of that. But I think that relates to, going into this next topic that I'd shared with you earlier, which was preparation. And so, you know, obviously it has many myriad components to it, but first of all, in training for being a backcountry traveler extraordinaire like you are, where would you like to take this? You know, either some of your general principles or something specific to a specific trip.
One of my trainers that I've worked with is Scott Johnston, and Scott and Steve House, the fairly infamous alpinist, wrote a book called Training for the New Alpinism, and then a follow-up called Training for the Uphill Athlete. I'm sure you're familiar mm-hmm. with those too.
Yes.
And when I was working with Scott, one of the things he told me was, you know, what's your goal here? And I said, well, my goal is I like at that time, my passion was I want to be able to do as much as possible in a 16-hour day. Like, I've got a 16-hour block of time. Make me resilient enough to allow me to do whatever I want in those 16 hours. And then also training for these long hikes without resupply. And so Scott told me that's not really what you want to do. And I said, okay. And he said, what we want to make you is indestructible as possible in the mountains. I see you're wearing a hat that says hard to kill. That's the other flip side to it. Okay. So allow you to accomplish at an extremely high level and not injure yourself. That's really what this is all about. And so that's always grounded me in my training philosophy. And so beyond that, the biggest investment of time I have always spent is in base aerobic training. If I can elevate my base, and it is an enormous amount of work, you cannot hack this process very much. You have to put in the time, and it's cumulative time that builds up over the course of years. So it's not like I'm going to do aerobic training for the next 3 months to get ready for my next hike. I've always had the perspective of, like you, I want to be in this for a lifetime. And I know the base training I do in 2021 is going to build upon what I've done the past 10 years. And it's going to contribute to what I want to do in the next 10 years. So I've always taken that long-term perspective. So the big part is build a giant foundation of base aerobic training, because once you have that foundation, then you can go into more specialized training that allows you to be resilient in specific situations, whether it's carrying a big pack up a steep incline, or it's ice climbing, or it's ultra running. So all these things have their own specific training types with them, but I don't think you can do any of that without hijacking this, or without developing a giant base.
Yeah, well said. And I totally agree. I think it is the foundation for, maybe health and longevity, first of all, but also, anybody who has endurance athletic goals or just long-term athletic goals, we can put that into context, but well said. So in addition to the aerobic base training, which I assume you're doing that in multiple modes, but a lot of it must be hiking itself. Are you doing, or do you like to do gym work?
I think gym work is critical. And part of my base training is doing general strength training. So the exercises that work the largest groups of muscles at a time. So squats, pull-ups, bench presses, things like this. So the mainstays of the exercise world, and really just trying to build muscle mass that then you can then hone later through max strength and endurance training, muscular endurance training. Muscular endurance training is my absolute favorite type of training, because that's like, once you develop the foundation and you start doing this, the amount of gains you get from doing muscular endurance training, just they're remarkable and noticeable. And it's a super exciting phase of training for me.
Yeah. It's fun to build that fatigue resistance. And do you do that type of training at a gym wherever you're located, or do you do some of this in a home gym setup?
I haven't had a gym membership in as long as, oh gosh, it's been at least 10 or 12, 13 years, maybe. So I do most of it at home. I have a very basic rack where I can do bench press and arm exercises and pull-ups. And then I use box steps. If I need to do specific training, I'll go buy a day pass at a gym to use free weights there and things like that.
Yeah, that's kind of an evolution I've seen as well. Obviously 2020 was a big impetus for many people, but over years, what I've found is I love a facility and it has its place in many places, in fact, but creating the win for a busy person who has a career, a business, a family, a mortgage, a spouse, a pet, you start naming these things. The wins all happen when we're reducing any time, wasted time, any complexity. So if you can go into a corner of your home or the back porch or the garage, and you've got a few simple items, some of which might come from Home Depot, for example, you know, you can train. And then that's sort of where one of my passions is, in helping people to find that way, as opposed to feeling like there's no hope. So thank you for, you know, sharing that and being a bit of an inspiration. Moving along, in, you've talked about it some, but a trip, so especially like the kind that you take, requires lots and lots of planning and logistics. And you've alluded to, you know, how you would do sections of things. And, you know, I think you might have said, you know, you test gear and you figure out what goes and what stays. But are there aspects of planning for heading into the backcountry that you think are critical that you could share with our audience?
I do. The big one I'm really studying now is food. And the reason I'm studying it so heavily is, number one, I'm getting older. I'm 51 years old and I don't have the body I did when I was in my 20s, where I could eat Fritos and corn nuts on a trip to get my calories and then expect my body to respond appropriately. It doesn't do that anymore. There's more inflammation. There's more GI distress. There's more time required for recovery. And so trying to pay attention to all these things nutritionally is really challenging. In fact, tonight we are giving a live stream Q&A for Backpacking Light, and we're talking about backcountry food planning. And one of my slides is on nutritional deficiencies for long distance hiking. And just seeing that it goes beyond caloric density, it goes beyond macronutrient balance. And you have to start paying attention to some of these little things that provide the catalyst to good health, not only day-to-day living, but when you're out in the backcountry, abusing your body, you're asking a lot of your body on these kinds of trips. You're putting yourself at risk for repetitive use injuries. So there's bone health issues. There's the general fatigue that comes from muscular exertion that needs to be restored every single night. There's proteins that need repaired. There's mental, there's cognitive decay that happens on a long trip that needs to be restored every night. And so I'm paying more attention to the quality of my sleep and the quality of my nutrition when I'm on a big hike. And that is a rabbit hole that has been incredibly fun to go down. And being able to experiment with nutrition over the past 5 years has completely changed how I feel on an athletic adventure like this.
You know, I'd like to talk more about that. Do you have a either specific dietary system that you follow in training? And then is that the same when you're out on a trip? And mainly I'm interested in, well, you know, what are the macros? Are you more of a keto guy? Or are you a high carb guy? I mean, what works for you?
My approach to food, both in daily life and in the backcountry, is I'm going to eat as much diversity and balance as possible. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is I've experimented with high carb, high protein diets, one high carb and one high protein, not at the same time. So looking at different ways to do this. And I think, you know, high carbs, I can be pretty successful on short adventures on a high carb, diet. I can be pretty successful on short adventures with a high protein diet. But if I try to do this for a week or 2 weeks or longer, it starts to break down. And I will acknowledge that part of that is my body's conditioning to it, because I don't practice those things on a regular basis. I have done them for several months at a time and experimented with them, but I've always gravitated back to finding a nutritional balance, at least in terms of macronutrients. So, you know, if you're distilling the function of carbs, protein, and fats, for me as an ultralight backpacker, carbs give me energy, protein gives me recovery, fats give me a caloric density boost. And so, you know, I know it's way more complicated than that, but I've always kind of said, okay, all three of these things are valuable to the types of trips I do. So I've always looked for a balance there. The other litmus test and I'm more sensitive to it now that I'm older, is that I want to eat what makes me feel good when I'm exerting myself. And so I've always let that be a guide. Are my energy levels high? Is my cognitive function high? Am I waking up in the morning with more aches than I should, or am I feeling ready to do it all over again? So I'm always letting that be a litmus test. And then in terms of micronutrients and vitamins and minerals, I'm a data scientist, so I like to measure stuff. So I've actually taken blood samples out in the backcountry and preserved them and had them analyzed back home. And I've taken a lactose meter with me. So I love to, like, data is really important to me. And so starting to realize that, like, B vitamin deficiency and D deficiency and calcium deficiency is happening on these long trips is enlightening, because it tells me, okay, I'm sacrificing my immune function, my ability to be resilient against stress fractures, and my ability for my muscles to recover. Maybe I'm sacrificing oxygen transport as well in some of these deficiencies. And so I've paid more attention to getting those vitamins from my foods, because that's my preference over supplements. But when I'm on a really intense athletic endeavor, I'll take a supplement with me too.
And you mentioned the gut, you know, gut health, agreeability, permeability. Do you practice with or train your gut to use the types of foods that you might be using on a trip in advance of the trip, just to make sure you don't have any surprises?
Well, I have done this, and I try to eat on my trips what I eat at home, and then there are no surprises. The challenge is in the forms of the food. So you're trying to save weight on food on a backcountry trip. So you tend to gravitate towards dry and dehydrated foods. Okay. There's two issues with this. One, when you heat dehydrate a protein or a fat and then try to rehydrate that in your gut, it causes issues. And those issues can be in the forms of a whole bunch of different GI distress issues, whether it's gas, bloating, cramps, or it can be nutritional deficiencies because it's harder to extract nutrients from heat dehydrated food. So one of the big changes I've shifted to in the past few years is moving towards more freeze-dried ingredients, because they are easier to digest and they are easier to rehydrate and they are easier to extract nutrients from. And so I've noticed significant changes from moving away from dehydrated foods and more towards freeze-dried foods. So that's probably one of the biggest changes I've made.
And you also alluded to sleep as, you know, being a critical component. And when I was speaking with you last week, you talked about one place to splurge is on your sleeping pad. Would you have some words to say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you look at these long distance hikers who are kind of starting out and young, you always see the Therm-a-Rest Z-Rest foam pad on the top of their through hiking backpack. And that's the most popular sleeping pad among through hikers. Some other forms of foam pads, I know some through hikers that use, you know, as thin as 1/8 of an inch, and then they're really careful about where they lay it down in the forest and things like that. But, you know, in the mountains, you don't have soft ground. And so my bones are far too old to sleep on a thin foam pad anymore. So I've gone through a variety of inflatables. I've settled on a good thick 3-inch inflatable insulated wide mattress. So I use a wide one, 25 inches wide. And that just gives me the depth of sleep I need to repair and recover. And that is weight well spent.
Yeah, I love that kind of thinking where, okay, the overall picture is ultra light. So where can we, you know, where do we need to go a little bit heavier and then reap those rewards or benefits or gains? About gear, you've kind of talked a little bit about materials and, you know, the different types of nylons and potentially polyesters that are available. you know, titanium got mentioned, I think carbon fiber. But if you did like a, not a full bag dump or pack dump, but just kind of like, what are the main things that you want to have? I know you've got a pack of good construction and you've got that sleeping pad, but maybe talk about tents, shelter, sleeping bags, cooking items, if you could.
Yeah. So on trips, like the Absorca backbone hike, my goal was to hike as many daylight hours as possible. And so that drove me to have a really, really simple kit. So I took a comfortable sleeping pad and I took a warm sleeping bag because in August, sub-freezing temperatures up there are fairly common. It's a northern latitude. But I skimped on things like shelter. So I took a bivy sack and then I opted to find places below the tree line where I could hunker down if it was raining or stormy. And I simplified my food quite a bit. So I would cook less and do more cold food. I have gravitated on those types of trips towards a technique called cold soaking, where I will put my freeze-dried meal inside my eating bowl, which has a lid on it, and fill it with water at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And then by the time I was ready to stop for dinner, it was hydrated and I could just eat it without cooking. Now, you run the risk of doing that with morale, because hot food and hot drinks really contribute to morale. So I have a balance of doing that now, and I do not cold soak in the winter months because it's just too hard. So, you know, on a trip like that, it's like, I want the gear to get out of the way because I want to walk. That's all I want to do. So I go for as simple and as light as possible, but not sacrificing the comfort I need to keep walking in a storm. So I'm going to carry a good rain jacket with pit zips for ventilation and something that might not be considered ultralight. And I'm going to carry a warm enough sleeping bag that I don't wake up shivering in the middle of the night, because that interrupts my recovery. Now, flip over to the other side of this, and like recreational backpacking, where I'm only hiking a few hours a day or 6 hours a day, and maybe I'm with families or friends and it's a more relaxed environment. Maybe backcountry fishing is the focus instead of alpine climbing or long distances. And so I'll bring some comforts with me. I'll bring a tent that allows me to hang out and read and not get eaten alive by mosquitoes. I'll bring a lightweight camp chair, because I have historical back issues and it feels really good to sit in a camp chair in the evening and cook my dinner. And you know, you pick your luxuries beyond that. And I'm not out of control with my luxuries, but I'm very intentional about the things that give me the most joy.
I've noticed in some of your videos that you enjoy a cup of coffee now and again.
Oh man, I love coffee. Coffee is like, if you have backcountry passions of fishing or climbing or photography, coffee is one of mine.
So what's your favorite way of preparing coffee, or most commonly used way in the backcountry?
In my day-to-day life, I have a pour over every morning with fresh ground coffee from our local roastery. And that is my favorite way to enjoy coffee in the backcountry. Now, that's not the way I always do it, because it requires a little more weight and a little more hassle, because you need to take along a dripper and you need to deal with the grounds. So I'm also an aficionado of trying various freeze-dried coffees, because we have more options now than just Taster's Choice and Starbucks Via. So there are some craft coffee makers that are making some outstanding freeze-dried coffees. I'll give a shout out to CS Coffee, because they are one of my favorites, and it's a very concentrated blend of coffee that goes a long way for very little weight.
And that's the initial CS?
Yes, C.S. Coffee.
Okay. I'll have to keep that in mind, maybe for me as well as some of the listeners, because I'd also share that fervent passion. I'm really enjoying our discussion, by the way, and much appreciative of you. I've always found you to be such a knowledgeable person in many things, including other than this topic. And you're a great resource, so I really appreciate that. Let's move into life perspectives a bit. And I think in kind of bringing things together from many of the things we've discussed, I would try to pull out some of your life perspectives as an athlete for life, and maybe begin with your thoughts on that unique enrichment and renewal that you get from wild places and from traveling in the backcountry, as opposed to only working out at the gym or walking in the park.
There's an innate human nature to want to thrive, which is, you know, if you look at the definition of thrive, it's along the lines of promoting personal growth and accomplishing something in spite of the fact that there may be barriers or difficult circumstances along the way. And so we live in a culture now that has a fire hose of information coming in. We are facing decisions every minute of every day. So our brains are on high alert, and that we're asking a lot of our brains cognitively every day just to cope with everything we have to cope with in a modern society. So for me, being out in nature is a way to turn that off. Now, that sounds a little bit like escapism, but for me, it's also healing. It's a way for me to come back to the day-to-day life of modern society and have a high functioning brain, emotional state, spiritual state, so that I can make good decisions when I have to make them. You know, I have a family and mortgage and all the things that everyone else does, and we have to make decisions every day, and being in nature allows me to just kind of desensitize to all the stimuli that is coming in from living in suburbia and turn that off and stay cognitively and physically healthy during the process.
Well said. So I want to wrap up with some specific advice that you can offer our audience. And I've got three things. I think I'll ask it one at a time just to keep things simple. And first of all, if you think of most of the people who listen to this show are, I want to say people like you and I, but I'll say people like me who are, you know, enthusiastic about trying to get the most out of their journey and have some pastimes, passions. They might be sports, it might be gardening, it might be playing with the grandkids, all that kind of thing. So many of these listeners probably either have never gone backpacking or have done so in ways that aren't harnessing all the wisdom that you're sharing with us. And so if you had any advice for a lifetime athlete listener who wants to just get out there and experience backpacking light and free, could you offer something?
You bet. The biggest barrier that people get intimidated by when they hear the words ultralight backpacking is the cost of the gear. And I'll acknowledge that there are some very high performant ultralight equipment out there that is very expensive. You know, if you start looking at Dyneema composite fabrics, carbon fiber, and titanium, and you're going to kit out with those three items, you're looking at a several thousand dollar kit. But my encouragement is to say, go with what you got and stay within the limits of what you got. So if you have a gear kit that allows you to hike 10 miles a day, but maybe not farther because it's not ultralight, don't wait to buy ultralight gear. Go out and do your 10 mile a day hike and focus instead on maybe leaving the luxuries behind, or, just simplifying your kit a bit. And you can save so much weight by just taking what you need. And in terms of experimenting, I would say, you know, take a little bit less than what you think you need and then go out for an overnighter and just see how that goes. If you have access to a state park or someplace that is a little bit lower risk in terms of being in a remote location, maybe try that and experiment. There are so many people in our community that spend the nights in their backyards tinkering or testing gear at their kitchen counters, or just going out, and we have a growing community of people who are like into urban and stealth camping, and this is part of their adventure. And so it's pretty remarkable what you can do. So focus on that regard without, you know, getting hung up on, wow, I don't have the gear to go hike the Pacific Crest Trail this year, you know.
And you made me think of something. So folks, first of all, keep in mind, this is a guy who hikes 20 miles a day above tree line, you know, at elevation, off trail. If anyone's ever tried to do that, it's of great magnitude. But one of the things that I found that one can do where it's available and where it's, of course, legal to do is, instead of staying on the trail and going for those 10 miles, maybe you just pop off and go a mile or two, conserving energy where you can, but you can find some wonderful camping opportunities. And it's sort of like front country or pseudo back country, but I think that's a nice way to use some of the tactics that you suggested, Ryan.
I am in between cities right now. I'm moving from Wyoming down to Colorado, and we're renting a place in near Allenspark, Colorado, kind of waiting for our new place to be finished. And we got really fortunate. We're renting this place on a large parcel of land that's filled with ponderosa forests and whatnot. And so I can't see any of my neighbors. And so I've been dying just to walk out 200 feet from the house and setting up my tent and spending the night out there. So yeah, there's a joy and satisfaction in just being in nature. And it can feel as remote as you want it. And I think we sometimes lack creativity in how to discover that connection to the natural world, and it's worth cultivating.
Yeah, like your own private wilderness doesn't have to be your own private Idaho in the Frank Church wilderness, for example. And next one up, as we're wrapping up, is okay. In going light, I think you've already, you know, hit on that. Like, each of us has to decide where we want to either spend or just be light. But is there a product or two in the gear kit, which it's almost always good to emphasize, get a light version of this thing first?
Well, you know, you and I live in the Rocky Mountains, which are relatively dry. And so the biggest one I always think of is the sleeping bag. You can go, like, a sleeping bag does not need to be super durable. You're not abrading it against anything. You're not bushwhacking with it wrapped around your shoulders, or at least hopefully you're not. And so you've got modern sleeping bags have incredibly light fabrics and incredibly high fill power down. So we can get sleeping bags now that are 850, 950, even 1,000 fill power down. And so you can get a sleeping bag or a quilt. I use a quilt often, that's comfortable enough down to freezing temperatures that weighs 18, 20 ounces. And to me, that, and they're not cheap. It's not an inexpensive investment, but, you know, a down quilt or sleeping bag can last many, many years and provide you with so much warmth and comfort. And we're starting to see this argument of down versus synthetic be kind of a straw man argument, because you can elevate your skills now to use down sleeping bags very successfully in wet environments. And it just requires awareness, knowledge of the down's limitations, and some attention to taking care of your product. So, you know, combine skills and high-end gear, you can save an enormous amount of weight, increase your comfort dramatically. And that's like one of the areas I always start with everybody is the sleeping bag.
That makes sense, especially when we talk about the value of sleep for every human and every lifetime athlete. Final thing now. So, you know, I've been enjoying visiting with you and looking at you across the screen. I mean, neither of us are the guys we were, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and I'm older than you are, but hey man, you look great. You look young, you look youthful, you're a vital beast. And what is your overall comment about that? I mean, I think you've hit on a lot of the things that you do, but you really are staying vital through the lifespan. You've got a ton of energy that you're putting into your work and your family. Any advice you've got, we will take it.
You know, we've been running Backpacking Light for 21 years, and it's been through a whole host of ups and downs. You know, as well as I do, that being a small business owner comes with immense challenges and time sacrifice. And The difference today versus the difference in running the company even 10 years ago, 12 years ago, is I have simplified vastly our processes, our staff. We kind of have this unspoken rule that we don't want drama anymore, and that informs what people we hire and how we deal with missed deadlines and failures and everything else. And so that change in perspective keeps everybody's cortisol down and keeps energy levels up. And so for me, work has become a way to play and enjoy and be an extension of a whole life that I really, really love, rather than something I have to do just to pay bills and you know, grow the stock price or whatever. So, you know, just reducing stress is probably the focus of the rest of my life, because the return on investment of keeping stress low is just so high. It opens up so much other mental and emotional space to pursue passion.
That's fantastic. Can't thank you enough for your time. It was a fabulous discussion, and I think there were so many topics that spun off that I'd love to get you back, perhaps on a regular interval, every 6-12 months, whatever you've got available, where you and I can dive into some of these subjects, which I think are so relative to what we're all doing, as well as for those people who are interested in, again, getting out in the backcountry.
John, I really appreciate it and have enjoyed it immensely myself, and looking forward to touching base with you again in the future.
What a great show, and thank you for being with us today. If you'd like to get in touch with Ryan or learn more about his many resources, simply go to backpackinglight.com. And if you have questions or comments for me, you can reach me at contact@thelifetimeathlete.com. And I welcome any and all of your inquiries, and I really do appreciate you being part of this community, being an athlete for life, being hard to kill, and being an inspiration to me. Best to you guys, and rock on.